Hey, Pastor Andrew here. Wanted to thank you for watching or listening to this sermon online. Before we get going, I did want to lay before you a conviction that we have as a church. We are hoping and praying that this sermon stirs up your affections for Jesus and helps mold and shape you into his likeness. But in no way should this online teaching replace the church that you should be involved with, and the pastor that God has placed into your life to care for your soul. So that being said, we do pray that this encourages and blesses you, and so please enjoy the proclamation of God's word.
Why don't you turn in your Bibles to Hosea chapter 1. The book of Hosea is in the Old Testament. And if you're not 100% sure, well, where is that? You know, you hit Ezekiel, you hit Daniel, just keep going a little bit, and Hosea is right after the book of Daniel. And so last week, if you weren't here, we kicked off our brand new series in the Minor Prophets, and we did a ton of work last week, and I'm not going to recap really any of it because there's just no time, but I would encourage you to go online and you can listen or watch the sermon from last week. But we did a lot of groundwork, a lot of just kind of laying a foundation for this whole series. If we're going to spend, you know, who knows, a couple of years walking through the 12 minor prophets, we wanted to ask some questions. Well, what is prophecy? What was the role of these Old Testament prophets? We asked even, you know, are there prophets today? So is there a quote, a Hosea that's going to stand up and say, you know, thus says the word of the Lord today? How do we actually read prophetic books of the Bible in a way that is not out of bounds, and where we just kind of, and I gave some examples last week of, you know, oh, Isaiah 45, oh, Trump's the 45th president, it's about him, and we laugh, but people actually do that, and that's a terrible way to read prophetic books of the Bible. So we laid a lot of groundwork. And then lastly, we looked at the first verse of Hosea 1. So we got through one verse last week, and it gave us the context of what is going on when Hosea was called by God to prophesy to Israel. Hosea's prophetic ministry spanned anywhere from, you know, some scholars say a minimum 25 years to possibly up to 38 years. So almost four decades Hosea prophesied and preached to Israel. And the book of Hosea that we have in our Bibles is a collection of his sermons and his prophecies that he gave. And we need to understand that Hosea saw quite a lot in his ministry. At the time when Hosea was called into his role, Israel was quite prosperous. If you remember last week, under the reign of Jeroboam, which is the king mentioned in verse 1, under his reign, Israel had known peace and prosperity for quite a while. And actually, kind of Hosea's generation, so some of these younger generations would have never had a memory of foreign oppression or war or hard times, because under Jeroboam's rule, Israel had known peace and prosperity for quite a while. There was no foreign oppression happening. There was no war. And they had peace. And they had had prosperity. And even if you read Chronicles, the land was producing great crops. So, I mean, they were sailing. Everything was kind of politically great. Now, coupled with that, peace and prosperity was pride and luxury and comfort, but also rampant sin and idolatry. I mean, we talked about it last week, but very rarely does prosperity and comfort lead to behavior that pleases God. And that's what we see in this time of Israel's life. They had peace and prosperity, and that led to behavior that was not pleasing to God. And so there was Baal worship, which included temple prostitution and other abominable practices. The priests were encouraging people to sin. The kings were encouraging drunkenness and frivolity and all of these things. And so during Hosea's ministry, think about that. He prophesies for maybe four decades. And he prophesied at the beginning when Israel was prosperous and there was comfort and ease all the way up to and after Assyria came in and wiped them out in 722 BC. And so Hosea really saw it all. He saw this decline happen in the northern kingdom over the course of almost 40 years. Now, chapters 1 to 3 in the book of Hosea are an interesting glimpse into his family life. And we're going to see that God called Hosea not only to preach and to prophesy against Israel, not just with his words, but also through his family life, through his wife and his kids. And so God effectively called Hosea, yeah, I want you to speak words, but I also want your family life to be a living parable of the judgment that God was pronouncing on Israel. God calls Hosea to marry an unfaithful woman to symbolize Israel's unfaithfulness. And then he commands Hosea to give his three children prophetic symbolic names to symbolize God's anger at what was happening in Israel. Now, it's really interesting because lots of people that I see online or I've talked to, they love Hosea 1, 2, and 3. But it's actually not meant to be the focus of the book. We, unfortunately, have placed way too much emphasis on it, and we try and get into answering questions that the text just doesn't give answers for. So Hosea 1, 2, and 3 is not the focus of the book. I mean, for goodness sake, there's 11 other chapters in this book of the Bible, but it is this kind of interesting glimpse into what Hosea's life was like. So in verses 2 to 9 this morning, we're going to see the condition of what was happening in Israel, what was going on with God's people. And it's interesting because the first words that we read in the book of Hosea, yes, it's the first words in Hosea, but Hosea is also the first book in the book of the 12, which is the name given to the 12 minor prophets. They're kind of lumped together, and it's called the book of the 12. And the words that we're going to read today kind of kick off the entire section of the minor prophets. And so it gives us kind of a summary statement or a glimpse at what was going on. If you wanted a thesis statement for the minor prophets, it would be this: there is a profound problem with God's people. There is something seriously wrong with God's people. And so this morning our passage deals with this incredible assignment that God gives to Hosea. Hosea's marriage was meant to be a constant reminder of God's message to the people of Israel, and Hosea's children were a constant reminder of God's message to Israel. Because think about it, if people who are living in the 8th century are anything like us, they probably talked about their kids. And names back then carried much more significance and weight. I mean, some of the names that we name our kids today, it's just crazy to me. I think parents just look at something on the wall and they're like, oh yeah, Siding, that will be my kid's name. It's just silliness. I'm like, pick good old-fashioned names. And you just wait till we name our son. Oh man, we're thinking of a doozy that's hard to pronounce and you can't say it correctly just to mess with you all. But names meant, they carried much more weight in those days. And oftentimes a parent would name a child based on a significant event in the life of the family. And so then think about it, because we kind of do that today. We name our kids, and either every name has meaning. So when people come and ask us, oh, what are your daughter's names? You know, Lucy and Ruby. Usually the second question is, why did you name them that? Or what does their name mean? That's often what it is. Why did you pick that name? And so we go, well, Lucy means light and Ruby means jewel, and there's some significance to that. So think about Hosea's family. And we're going to get into what he was commanded to name his kids. But anytime anyone asked him, hey, what's your son's name? What's your daughter's name? And then he said that, people would go, why did you name your son that? Why did you name your daughter that? So every conversation about Hosea's family would have brought up the idea of God's judgment. So we want to walk through these verses today, starting in verse 2 of Hosea chapter 1. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. So the first thing, notice that when the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the first thing God says to Hosea is just unbelievable. God tells Hosea, Hosea, I want you to go and take for yourself a wife of whoredom. And the reason being, and we're told why, because in God's eyes, the people of Israel, His chosen people, were committing whoredom through their idolatry and their apostasy. So remember, like I said, God often called His prophets, don't just speak my words, but I want you to actually live them out as well. And so Hosea's marriage was going to be a prophetic act for the people of Israel. Now, there's four views on who Gomer was and what this whole marriage was about. And it was interesting when we decided, okay, minor prophets, and we're going to start with Hosea. I went and bought some commentaries on Hosea, and every commentary that I opened, like the first page, Hosea is the most debated book in the Bible. I was like, oh, great. Why did we do this? There is a lot of debate around Hosea and who he was and what the marriage was. And there's actually much Hebrew in the book of Hosea that is not used anywhere else in antiquity. Not just the Bible, no Hebrew anywhere else in any recorded. So we go, what is happening with this book? And so there's four views that scholars have about who Gomer was and what this marriage was all about. So the first view is that, well, maybe this was a hypothetical marriage. So maybe this was simply a vision given to Hosea, or possibly maybe it was just an allegory. Maybe it was just a story that he was supposed to tell. Now, the main reason some scholars cling to this view is because that they find it very difficult to see God commanding Hosea to marry a whore. And many times scholars who have it couldn't be a real marriage, it's almost like they're trying to defend God's character. Surely God would not command Hosea to go and do something like that. So it can't be a real marriage. So the only problem with that view is that there's nothing in chapters 1 to 3, nothing in the text to suggest that this was a vision or an allegory or just a story that Hosea was supposed to share. From everything that we read in the text, Gomer was a real woman who Hosea married, and they had three real children together. Now the second view is, well, maybe Gomer was guilty of spiritual adultery, spiritual infidelity. Not physical. Maybe God's command for Hosea to marry a wife of whoredom, he just meant spiritually. Gomer, like the rest of Israel, they were spiritually adulterous. And so maybe it's just kind of, she was just lumped in with that. Again, the problem with that is that there's not a whole lot in the text that suggests that Gomer was just spiritually adulterous and not physically adulterous. And again, that view is a way to go, well, let's try and protect God's reputation a little bit. The third view is that Gomer was a prostitute, possibly a cult prostitute, caught up in Baal worship, and then Hosea was commanded to go and marry a prostitute. This by far is the most popular view because I think it seems to pack the most punch. I mean, we love it, whether you admit it or not, we love like the scandal of it, and we go, man, that seems like really scandalous. Wow, I think that's what it is. I mean, if you think of the Francine Rivers novel, if you've read it, I mean, and it's based on Hosea, and the guy goes and he marries a prostitute, and oh, he loves her so much, and we just love that kind of story. Look at the love that Hosea had to go and love this unlovable woman. But as much as we go, man, that sounds like a great story, I don't think it's accurate and faithful to the text. The fourth view, and the view that I hold and I believe holds up the most, is that Gomer was faithful when she and Hosea were married. Now, if that were the case, why would God use such a strong word like whoredom to describe her? And we need to get in the original language, the word whoredom that is used, and you're going to see it, it's used all throughout the book of Hosea. It's a very broad term for various kinds of sexual misconduct, and actually only in few certain contexts does it actually mean prostitution. It generally and most commonly refers to a married woman who is unfaithful to her husband. So we shouldn't necessarily believe, well, Gomer was already promiscuous when Hosea married her. A wife of whoredom doesn't describe her condition at the time of marriage, but it anticipates what she indeed proved to be. So whoredom is referring to a trait in Gomer, not a profession. So what God calls Hosea to do is essentially this. God says, Hosea, I want you to marry a woman who is going to cheat on you. God says, Hosea, I want you to marry someone who is going to sleep around on you, who's going to end up being unfaithful to you. And so think about that for a second. That is still incredibly difficult to hear. Like, men, if you were, God came and said, hey, I want you to marry someone, and by the way, she's going to sleep with a whole lot of other men while you're married. That's devastating. And this is what God calls Hosea too, and we can assume that Gomer did just that based on chapter 2, which we're going to get to next week, and we can assume Gomer even did receive money and gifts from the men that she slept with, because that's laid for out for us in chapter 2. So the tragedy of Hosea is a marriage that began well but went bad. And it makes sense, because remember why God commanded Hosea to marry a wife of whoredom. And he tells us why. For the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. And the land simply means the nation of Israel. The covenant partner of Yahweh had transgressed this sacred union by pursuing whoredom, by sleeping around, so to speak, with other false gods. So just like Hosea and Gomer, God and Israel, they actually had a decent beginning that went absolutely haywire because of Israel's unfaithfulness. Think about it. When they were at Mount Sinai and God said, here's the covenant, we're told in Exodus that all the people said, yes, we will keep this covenant, we will follow you, God. And it did not take long at all for them to then disobey and sin and chase after other things. But it started well. Just like I believe Hosea and Gomer's marriage was a marriage that began well, but then went absolutely haywire. So verse 4, in verse 3 we're told that he marries Gomer, and she is conceives and bears him a son. Verse 4, the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel, and on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So what is going on here? I mean, of all Hosea's kids, Jezreel kind of gets off easy. At least his name is somewhat normal. But you got to ask, what is going on here? Hosea's first son, and God says, name him Jezreel. What is the significance of that name? So Jezreel is the name of a city. And we see at the end of verse 5 there, in the valley of Jezreel. So the valley of Jezreel and then the city of Jezreel is in the valley of Jezreel. And it's the name of a city where a man named Jehu slaughtered the house of Ahab in order to take over and then begin his reign. And Jeroboam, so the king that we read about that's currently in Hosea's day, ruling and reigning, he is the fourth king of the dynasty that was began by Jehu in 841 BC. So we've got to make sure we get this. So in 841 BC, Jehu slaughters Ahab, slaughters his whole family, becomes king, and four kings later, we have Jeroboam, who's now ruling and reigning. So this was the longest dynasty in the northern kingdom of Israel. And the blood of Jezreel that's mentioned in our passage refers to 1 Kings 21, which you can look up later. But we know that Ahab was a man who promoted Baalism. Ahab worshipped Baal, promoted that other people would worship Baal. Ahab was a man who plotted to kill another man, stole his vineyard. And then Jehu, like I mentioned, came in and slaughtered the house of Ahab. Now here's where the interesting thing is. If you read that whole account in 2 Kings 9 and 10, we see that God actually commended Jehu for doing this. God actually wanted Jehu to do this. And so then we go, well, wait a second. So if God wanted Ahab dead and Jehu killed him, why now is God saying, I'm going to punish Jehu for what he did? We go, okay, is God schizophrenic? Is he kind of jumping back and forth? When you read the account of what Jehu did, he went far above and beyond what God had asked him to do. Yes, God had said, Jehu, I want Ahab dead. But Jehu went and killed all of his family, killed way more people. slaughtered everyone in Ahab's family, which he was never commanded by God to do. And so Jehu had killed for his own personal advances, and he wanted to set up the beginning of his dynasty. And so what God is saying here is that just like the house of Jehu, this dynasty that was began by bloodshed at Jezreel, it's going to end like that for him. Not only is the dynasty of Jehu going to end, but the entire kingdom of Israel as a nation is going to end. Just like a violent situation happened at the beginning of Jehu's reign, it's going to be paralleled by a violent situation at the end. And so the naming of Hosea's first son was to remind people of this dynasty of evil kings that had existed and ruled in the northern kingdom that God was going to put an end to. So God says in verse 5 that he's going to break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And that's just a euphemism, a saying that he was going to utterly destroy their army. When you broke someone's bow, it would just, they're helpless. They can't even fight back. And so he says, that's what I'm going to do to Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now, as an aside, it's really interesting because Israel has a lot of history with this valley. That upon hearing that, the people of Israel would have kind of known exactly what God... The Valley of Jezreel is where Gideon defeated the Midianites. The Valley of Jezreel was where King Saul was defeated by the Philistines. The Valley of Jezreel was where Josiah was defeated by the Egyptians. So lots happened, significant things happened in this valley. And God then says, I am the one who's going to break the bow of Israel in the Valley of Jezreel. So that's Hosea's first son. Call him Jezreel. Verse 6, she conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said to him, call her name No Mercy. For I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. So Gomer conceives, and they have a daughter, and Hosea is instructed by God, name her No Mercy. Lo Ruhamah in Hebrew. And basically, if you translate that literally, literally the name is, she has not received mercy, or she is not pitied. So think about that again. Like I've been in the room when both my daughters were born. I'm holding my daughters, and I can't imagine God saying, I want you to name your daughter No Mercy. And the word mercy, Ruhamah, comes from the root word in Hebrew, womb. So to think about like a mother's womb and the protection that is there for the child, God says, no more. No more mercy. So again, it was meant to shock people, that people who knew that Hosea was a prophet and this daughter has a prophetic name given to her, No Mercy. And God says, I'm no longer having mercy on the house of Israel and I'm not going to forgive them. So the reason that this would be so shocking is because of the character of God when he revealed himself to his people. If you remember in Exodus 34, Moses asks, okay, God, I want to see you. And God says, well, no one can see me and live, but I'm going to put you in the cleft of the rock and I'm going to cover you up and I'll pass by you. And God says, and when I pass by you, I'll proclaim my name to you. So Exodus 34 says, the Lord descended in the cloud, stood with him there, and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. So this would have been a shocking message for God who revealed himself. His very name is mercy. Slow to anger, forgiving sin, to say to Hosea, name your daughter No Mercy because I will no longer have mercy on Israel. It's as if Yahweh, God himself, is saying, I'm no longer the merciful one. But then God says in verse 7 that he will have mercy on Judah, on the southern kingdom. And so we need to ask, okay, well, why? Why, again, is God just kind of flipping a coin, picking favorites? Like, what is going on here? So remember that the nation, 200 years before Hosea's time, they had split into two kingdoms. So you had Israel in the north, and you had Judah in the south. And they were separate kingdoms, and they had separate kings. Now, what's really fascinating is that when you look at the history of the kings, if you read 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, if you read the history of these kings, in the northern kingdom of Israel, not one king was righteous. In the history of the entire northern kingdom, not one king was righteous. Not one of them sought after God. All of the kings in Israel in the northern kingdom were wicked and rebellious. But when you read about the kings in Judah, the southern kingdom, some of them sought after God. Some of them tried to bring the kingdom back to holiness and righteousness. Some of them destroyed idols and tried to, again, reinstate the law. You have Asa, you have Jehoshaphat, you have Joash, you have Amaziah, you have Uzziah, you have Jotham, you have Hezekiah, you have Josiah. All of those were kings in the south. And while not perfect, there were kings in Judah who sought after God, who attempted to put away idolatry. And so God, in his mercy, spared them, not forever, because we know eventually they were too captured and sent into exile. But the northern kingdom, Israel, we know they fell first. And we know that Judah was ravaged by Assyria, but Jerusalem itself did not fall, and the line of David stayed on the throne. So God says, I will no longer have mercy on the northern kingdom, my people. And yet he says, yet I will have mercy on Judah. So call this daughter that's born to you, Hosea, call her no mercy. Verse 8, when she had weaned no mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. So now verses 2 to 9 reaches this climax with this third child that's born. God says to Hosea, call him not my people, or lo ami in Hebrew. Israel's apostasy and idolatry had become so great that God could no longer put up with them. He had to divorce them, so to speak. Now the reason this third child's name would be so startling, again, is what God said about himself in Exodus chapter 6. If you remember when God was speaking with Moses, and Moses is saying, well, God, like, who are you? Who should I say sent me? Like, what's the deal here? And God says, say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burden of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. And here it is. I will take you to be my people. And I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who's brought you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. So God said to Moses, tell the people, I'm going to take you to be my own people, and I'm going to be your God. And now God says through Hosea, the Israelites aren't my people anymore. So it signifies this break of this covenantal bond that God had made with Israel. God says, you're not my people anymore. And not only that, but he says, I'm not your God. Now, in the original language, that's actually a play on words. Because the name of God, how God revealed himself to the Israelites, again, if you remember in Exodus, he said, tell them I am sent you, right? I am who I am. And I am is the name of God, Yahweh. So when God says in our text this morning, I am not your God, in the original language, he's saying, Lo Yahweh, not I am. So what God is saying is in this play on words, he's saying, well, as a result of Israel's faithlessness, it's as if my name is reversed. God, I've changed my name to reflect the breaking of the relationship between him and Israel. God says, I'm not Yahweh to you anymore. God is saying, you're not my people, and I'm not the I am to you anymore. I mean, this is meant to speak of being fully disowned. So think about it. It cannot get much worse than this for Israel. God is going to end the dynasty of Jehu, and he says, I'm going to end Israel itself. God will not have mercy on Israel anymore. He will not forgive them. God says, you're not my people. I'm not Yahweh to you. I mean, verses 2 to 9 is devastating. And it's meant, through Hosea's marriage and the naming of his children, it's meant to be this living, prophetic parable that it is designed to hopefully shake Israel out of its apostasy and idolatry and smack some sense into them. Like, we're meant to feel the weight of this. We're meant to go, man, God who says he's merciful is not going to have mercy anymore. God who says he's the I am is saying he's not the I am anymore. Like, God is using strong language. And we're meant to feel the weight of it. In verses 2 to 9, we're meant to feel that there's no hope. God is angry. His judgment is real because of Israel's rampant sin and depravity and idolatry. And yet, verses 10 till the end of the chapter are meant to be a massive contrast. God was saying in Hosea's day, hey, judgment is coming. God was saying, I'm disowning you. I'm sending judgment. And we need to understand, God has every right to. Because oftentimes what happens is, and I hear this lots from people, well, you know, the Old Testament, God just seems angry all the time. And why is he so judgmental? And we have to understand, God has every right to judge his people. Because these were people who stood at the bottom of Mount Sinai and said, yes, we will obey you, God. And they didn't. So God in his holiness has every right to do this. And yet we see unbelievable hope in the end of the chapter. Verse 10, yet, God says. So, like, imagine this. God says, I'm going to punish Jehu. I'm going to end your kingdom. I'm going to have no mercy on you anymore. I'm not going to forgive you anymore. You're not my people. I'm not God to you. And then he says, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. And they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, you are my people. And say to your sisters, you have received mercy. So we need to understand that it's not as if God is schizophrenic and in one moment he's saying, I'm not merciful anymore. And now he's saying, no, I am merciful. That's not what's happening here. We're meant to see these character traits of God held in perfect tension. On one hand, we see God's justice, his anger and wrath at sin, and his perfect holy judgment against depravity and wickedness and idolatry. And yet in the same moment, we see held in perfect tension his never-ending mercy, his faithfulness, and his love. Now, that's not to say that God's love just trumps his justice. And I've heard that described. Well, yeah, God is just and holy, but he's more loving than he is just. That is not true. All of God's attributes are equal. Because we know from history, God did pour out his justice on his people. And yet what God is saying is, I'm going to punish you for your rebellion, and yet I can't abandon you. And it's because of his own character. Because we see in verse 10, God goes all the way back to his covenant that he made with Abraham. If you remember that, he almost quotes it. The number of the children of Israel will be like the sand of the sea. That's what he said to Abraham. Your descendants are going to be like the sand on the sea. They're going to be like the stars in the sky. So Israel's failure could not nullify the promises that God made to Abraham. So he's remembering his covenant. God is saying, yes, I'm going to punish you, Israel, but I can't forget my promise to make you into a great nation and to bless you. So that's why we see this unbelievable contrast. God says in verse 10, in that place where it was said, you're not my people, you're going to be called children of the living God. Verse 11, God promises Israel and Judah, so the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. He says, you're going to be gathered together and you're going to appoint for yourselves one head, one leader, one ruler. So what's interesting about this is that after the people returned from the Babylonian exile, which happened after Assyria, Israel and Judah, they did reunite into one kingdom, but they never appointed one leader. That didn't happen in Hosea's time, and that has not happened to this day. Because God is pointing forward to a future age where God's people would unite under one ruler. And who do you think that ruler is? Jesus. I mean, this didn't even happen when Jesus came the first time. Because the Jewish people, the Israelites, rejected Jesus. So this promise that God is giving is pointing forward to the second coming of Jesus, where Jesus will come and his people, and hear this, not just Israel, not just Judah, but all of his people will be united under his rulership and authority. So see, even in this first chapter in Hosea, almost 800 years before Jesus came to give his life to purchase our salvation, God was telling them that their problem could only be fixed through faith, not the law. See, what God is saying is, Israel, you are too far gone. I can't have mercy on you anymore, Israel. I can't forgive you anymore. You're not my people anymore. I'm not Yahweh to you anymore. You can't possibly live up to your end of the covenant. You can't be saved through the law. The only thing that could save them was grace through faith. Because notice, when God says, I'm going to have mercy on Judah, I'm going to save Judah, notice that he says, I'm not going to save them by bow or sword or war or horses or horsemen. How is he going to save them? Through his grace. So we have to ask, well, how is it possible then to have such a contrast between verses 2 to 9 and then 10 to the end? And the answer is, it's only possible because of the miraculous power and love of God that can bring grace to such a vile and rejected people. And God shows us this in chapter 2, verse 1. Remember the names Hosea gives his kids. And God says, say to your brothers, you are my people. So say to not my people, you are my people. Say to your sisters, you've received mercy. So say to no mercy, you've received mercy. And so we ask, well, how is that possible? And it's possible not by anything the Israelites could have done. They were too far gone. And even Judah, right? We can look at the southern kingdom and go, well, they had some good people, but it was a matter of time. And even they gave in to full idolatry and depravity. And yet future restoration and mercy and grace is possible because of who God is, not because of anything that Israel did. See, this is really important because oftentimes Christians, we have this view of, well, the Old Testament, all of the Old Testament people achieve salvation through the law. Sometimes we think that, well, the Israelites, if they obeyed enough and they did enough, well, they had salvation through the law. Or maybe, oh, okay, so they sacrificed animals and they had salvation through that. And then we have this idea, well, then Jesus came and now we're saved by faith in God, by faith in Jesus through his grace. But listen, none of the Israelites were saved by keeping the law. The law, Paul even tells us, is that the law didn't save anybody. The law was given so that we would know that we need a Savior. The law was given so that we go, really? This is what we have to live up to? This is impossible. That's the point of the law. And so people in the Old Testament were saved the same way we are, by faith. In God. So even Abraham, think about it, in Romans chapter 4, it talks about Abraham. And it doesn't say Abraham was a really great guy and he tried to obey and so God saved him. No, it says Abraham trusted in God and God counted that to him as righteousness. So think about that. God nowhere in the Old Testament says, Israel, I will give you eternal life and salvation if you can just keep the law. The law was never meant for that. So God in the Old Testament is just as righteous and faithful as he is in the New Testament. His character didn't change. Now, here's why this passage is so exciting. Hosea 1, both Paul and Peter quote Hosea 1 in the New Testament. The book of Hosea is actually quoted and referenced 30 times in the New Testament. And Paul says this in Romans chapter 9, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he's prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom he's called, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles, as indeed he says in Hosea, those who were not my people, I will call my people. And her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God. Peter says this in 1 Peter 2, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possessions, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Look at this. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. See, what was happening in Israel is not unique to Israel. The depravity and idolatry and apostasy and going on in Israel is the human condition. Ever since the fall, ever since Adam and Eve rebelled in the garden, the default mode of the human heart is sin, is rebellion, is wickedness, is depravity. That's the default mode of your heart and my heart. And God, in his justice, he can look at all of Israel, but not only that, God can look at all of humanity, and God rightfully and justly can say, no more mercy, and you're not my people. See, some people have this idea that, well, human beings were inherently good. Like, we're just good people. There's good in us, which is biblically untrue. I mean, Romans 3 tells us there's no one who's good. There's no one who seeks after God. Jeremiah 17 says your heart is desperately sick and wicked. And many other people have this idea, well, we're all just God's children. And usually those two ideas go hand in hand. We're all good and we're all God's children, which again is fundamentally untrue. Because in John chapter 1, speaking of Jesus, it says he came to his own and his own people didn't receive him, but all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. You're not born good and you're not born a child of God. When you trust in Jesus, Jesus gives you the right to become a child of God. So hear me. Hosea 1 is not just God being mad at the Israelites because they're sinning and telling them, well, I'm just going to destroy you. Hosea 1 gets to the root problem of humanity. Humanity is so far gone, so sinful, and so rebellious that nothing we do can fix the problem. The Israelites couldn't keep the law. They couldn't obey because of their own sinful hearts. Just like all of us cannot achieve salvation on our own. We can't be good enough. We can't obey enough. We can't give enough. There's nothing that we can do. So Hosea 1 is not just about Israel. It's about all of us. And the reason I say that is because Peter and Paul both say this is about everyone. This is about humanity. So hear that. The Israelites were so far gone that it's as if they were Gentiles. God says, you're not even my people anymore. You're all lumped into this category of none of you are my people anymore. That's where we land. So we have to ask, how can God go from saying, you're not my people, to calling us children of the living God? How can God go from there's no more mercy to you've received mercy? And it's only because of his character and his grace and his goodness. And God in his goodness and mercy had his plan of redemption before the foundation of the world. He was going to send his son. Jesus came and he perfectly fulfilled the law. What the Israelites and what none of us could ever do. And Jesus went to the cross and he died the death that we deserve for our rebellion, and the wrath and the anger of God was poured out onto him instead of us. And Jesus rose from the dead and he conquered sin and death. And now scripture tells us that when we believe in him, when you receive Jesus and you trust in his name, you're given the right to become children of God. I mean, that's what we see in Hosea 1. God is saying to his people, you are so far gone. So rebellious and so wicked and so idolatrous that you need to be punished. And God is saying, and yet I will show you mercy in the future. One day you're going to be reunited, one people under one head, Jesus. To those of you who are not my people, you will be called children of God. That's not just the Jews, but that's Gentiles as well, Paul and Peter tell us. That's you and me, wicked, rebellious people who don't deserve mercy and aren't God's people. Because of Jesus, God can say, you are my people and you have received mercy. You're welcomed into God's family and you're shown mercy. And it's amazing because not only the New Testament, but Hosea tells us where that happens. In verse 10, God says this, and in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, It shall be said to them, children of the living God. Where is that place? In that place. Because you need to hear, it's not a geographical location. God's not saying, hey, if you just come to this location geographically, that's where I'm going to call you children of the living God. So where is the place? It's repentance. It's the place where you get to where you're broken over your sin, where you're broken over your rebellion. It's the place where you stop trying on your own to somehow measure up to God's standards. The place where you go from being not my people to children of the living God is the gospel. It's Jesus. So this morning, I would encourage you, if you've never come to that place, oh, that you would see your rebellion and your sin and realize that the only way that you can be made right with God, the only way that you can receive mercy, the only way that you can actually be called a son or a daughter of God is through faith in His Son. That you would see the holiness of God and His justice, and yet you would see His mercy, that because of His character and because of the gospel, because of Jesus, He can look at people who are not His people and say, you can be children of the living God. Again, it's so good to be reminded, our salvation has nothing to do with us. Israel's salvation has nothing to do with them. God didn't look at Israel, and we know that. God didn't look at Israel and say, because you're such a great people, I'm going to choose you to be my people. They were nothing. There was nothing pleasing about them. It's because of God. So again, God doesn't look at your goodness and go, you know what? Andrew's pretty good. He tries pretty hard. He keeps like 40% of my rules. Okay, there's enough good in him. I'll accept him. No, when God looks at me apart from Jesus, I'm nothing. And yet, when you trust in Jesus, when God looks at you, He doesn't see your ability to not measure up. God sees His Son. So the only thing that we contribute to our salvation was the sin that made it necessary. We bring nothing to the table. The Bible is clear. Faith is a gift. Grace is a gift. Even the ability to repent is a gift. So Hosea 1 shows us God's justice and His holiness and His righteousness, and yet it's held in balance with His love and His mercy towards humanity. Israel is going to be punished. And we know that judgment did come when Assyria came in 722 and wiped them out. And yet God, all throughout Hosea, we're going to see God says over and over, I can't give you up. There is going to be a day when all of God's people, Jews and Gentiles, will unite under the lordship of Jesus in God's kingdom. And again, I need to stress that will happen not based on anything you or I can do, but solely based on the faithfulness and mercy of God.